Actually, it was very interesting. So when Charles was just speaking about how fire affected Australia, that to see how one burning event of our landscape, how that severely affected it. I mean, I'll say we're riddled with pop-up eucalypts. And I think we lost all of the cherry bolete, which is a native cherry. From what I understand, someone had told me that it works sort of parasitically. I like to say symbiotically. It sounds mean, parasitically.
Basically.
It's a tree that grows off another tree. It's got beautiful wood. It looks like cherry wood. Like that's why
Awesome.
they call it native cherry. I think they're all burnt on the property, hey? They're all gone.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. One fire event. So you can then start to understand if this is happening time and time again, how a landscape can change.
TheWellnessCouch.com, streaming wellness into your lives. Download the app today.
G'day and welcome to Nutritious Conversations. I'm your host, Duncan McMahon. My intention is that these chats with my guests add as much richness to your life as they do mine. And you too can be inspired to indulge in nutritious conversations with friends, family, and complete strangers. Big love and enjoy. Welcome to another edition of Nutritious Conversations with myself, Dunk. I've got my beautiful sister and brother-in-law here, Danielle McMartin and Charles Boddy. And we've just launched into a massive conversation prior to hit record, and I've gone, my gosh, we need to record this. So we're going to have a bit of a discussion around a bit of their background, of their passion for the farm that they're in, the interests within that space, their connection with a gentleman that we're looking at interviewing very soon, Peter Andrews, who's an incredible wealth of knowledge, but also the passion for life that sort of sits between, you know, with these two beautiful souls. So we were talking. Actually, I'll launch into it first. Charles, what book are you reading at the moment, mate?
I'm still reading the Burning Bush by, I think Danny showed you the other day.
Yeah, The Burning Bush, wasn't it? Yeah.
Professor Stephen Pine.
Yeah. What's that about?
Yeah, he's a professor, and I can't remember exactly the stream, but he's a fire expert.
Mm-hmm.
And he studied the effects that fires had on the ecology, I guess, the ecosystems all around the world, and how humans, you know, the anthropogenic fire, obviously there's natural fire events from lightning. But yeah, he's looked at how anthropogenic fire has changed ecosystems all around the world.
So the anthropogenic being man-made fires, slash and burn.
And yeah, I didn't realise, but yeah, most countries have been through it, England included. They burnt the crap out of it, and yeah, they went to India and burnt the crap out of that for a long time. And I haven't been to India, but from what I gather, it's almost desertified.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, obviously here in Australia, it's pretty well documented how humans have been burning it for a long time.
Okay.
What's not so documented, I guess, is what that's done, what it's caused to our ecosystems, landscapes, and it's been a complete change of systems. You know, the plant species, I think I was telling you the other day, over six, well, one scientist says that I've heard Peter talk about, says over 60%, but there's another scientist I was talking to recently, and because I was looking for a reference to so I can quote, you know, scientific journals or whatever about these numbers.
Mm-hmm.
But I haven't actually been able to find that yet. But this guy said that it could be more like 99% of plant species have been extinct due to humans burning the landscape.
Mm-hmm.
And that was sort of before white fellas even got here.
Yep, yep.
Because we haven't stopped. You know, we've burnt the crap out of it as well.
Yep.
And
in Australia.
In Australia, yeah.
Yeah, and the natural and the non-natural clearing of the land as well.
Yeah.
Well, that's another reference book. She's an Australian paleobotanist. She's passed away now, but it's called After the Greening, the Browning of Australia. So that's where some information about what species, some of the species that would have been in Australia.
Yeah, so that, I mean, this is where the you know, we look at the megafauna that we actually had within Australia. And I think we were chatting the other day about this with the, you know, we have wombats the size of cows, you know, and, you know, for those species to survive, you need to have a mega flora or at least a very nutrient dense biodiverse flora, you know, that would support them, you know, and
get that big and healthy. Yeah.
Get that big and healthy.
To develop them in the first place and then support them. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, there's certainly, and this is the interesting thing. Cause I mean, you know, what we should be doing is having discussions around this, you know, where the assumption is this controversial. Well, let's have the discussion, you know, let's have a look into this, because I think we're seeing attack being taken or direction being taken with, you know, and it'd be lovely to go into this a little bit with you guys too, is, you know, the global warming that's occurring, the high percentage of, you know, CO2 in the atmosphere, which is being perpetuated you know, the agendas that seem to be running with that. But there seems to be a complete lack of understanding of the impact of latent heat and how water plays an important part in that. But before we actually go down that avenue, what book are you reading, Danny?
I just wanted to just touch back to that megafauna you were talking about, and I'll show you the book I'm reading. But it's a missing link. Like, we all know that these massive animals existed, but like, why? Like, what, you know, what's, yeah, like Charles said, what sustained them? What got them to that stage? And so it's that biodiversity. So in saying that, this is my passion, are hedgerows.
The hedgerows. Oh, we've got to go there.
Yeah. And, well, actually, I usually have about 5 books on the go.
Yeah.
But this is one of them. And it's just it's the ecology of hedgerows and field margins. So it's a whole heap of scientists, really, really well referenced. What I love about it is it has a big section on the effects of biocide on the landscape. Because they've got a declining hedgerow, so they've in England, so they've actually allocated funding. Which doesn't happen too much in Australia, to go and work out why this is happening. And so they've been able to see that with the use of biocides and, oh, they call them pesticides, but we in Australia, when we think of pesticides, we think, oh, we're just spraying insects, but their pesticides includes herbicides, fungicides, like includes everything. So I just take it from Walter Yaney. He's a soil microbiologist who used to work for CSIRO, and he calls them biocides. So any life killer. So I just call it all biocides. So anyone using biocides. So they've got a really good section about biocides and incredibly well referenced. We've got scientists from all over the world, agroecologists, like all sorts, you know, pages and pages of referencing scientists. Like, they've obviously had to be very careful and very thorough. Yeah, so it's really interesting.
Well, that's fascinating. So there's a few words I want to sort of work on from a definition perspective and what they actually mean, you know. So the first word I want to go, and I'll throw this to you, Charles, sequestering. What does that mean?
Drawing in, I'm not sure, but yeah, I'll make up, you know, we'll say words that come to me about it. It's not something I've thought about, what it actually means to sequester, but I guess it means to draw in, to take in, to
So within the context of the land and what you guys have been doing, you know, the sequestering of
Sequestering carbon is the term that you hear a lot. So I guess that is to take the carbon out of the atmosphere and put it into the soil. What they're aiming to do with sequestering carbon, but maybe not necessarily just in the soil. They're probably trying to work out some sort of manufactured machine to suck it in.
That concept, because that there's always like from what we do with work on the landscape, and we're continually, I guess, people in this area continually looking for funding, and one of the benefits of what we do is it does sequester a lot of carbon, there's something a bit dodgy about the carbon credits, and what I don't like is, so you go into a partnership with company or an organization, it's not clear to me the arrangements, and when something isn't 100% clear, I just think, okay, I don't particularly like this. So you go into an arrangement with a company and you'll get funding to do sequester carbon on your land. Now, what does that mean long term? Do they own your land? What are the arrangements? What are the legalities? Like, so as a farmer, if you want to go down that track of getting carbon credits, just really do research as to what that means for you in your landscape. The other thing that really put me off carbon credits is I started looking up things like, I don't agree with biochar, because I don't agree with, I just look at things when you start to do things on a large scale. The other is that there's been sort of feasibility studies done internationally about using biochar along with using pesticides and fertilizers and being able to claim carbon credits.
The biochar, is that like a potash or something like that? Or is that, what's a biochar?
Oh, they call it pyrolysis. Like, there's this pyrolysis. Like, if I don't get the technical terms right, they'll forget me. But as far as I can see it, simply you have a raw material and you make it into something you sprinkle on your land. Now, that raw material is a carbon-based material, a plant, and then it goes through a I just want to say they burn it, and then they make they go through pyrolysis. Pyro, yeah. So they change the name, this fancy name, pyrolysis. Yeah. And like I said, they'll jump down my throat with this, but and then it comes out as this product, and they spread it on your land. And I'm like, okay, well, you could keep that carbon-based product in large, and you've lost energy. You've lost the energy of that by burning it, by converting it. So just compost it, just mulch it and compost
it. Just mulch it, which is interesting. And the reason why.
It means just another industry that wants to charge farmers money. And to be honest, farmers are going broke, and farmers are committing suicide, and farmers have got depression, and they're paying more and more for inputs, and they don't need to. All the resources are on their farm. And so when another thing like biochar comes out and they tell people to put it on the land and how great it's going to be, incidentally, you have to either mix it with some sort of type of humic acid or some type of other natural fertilizer or something. So on its own, it's not even 100%, like, it's not even effective. Yeah, right. So you still have to do something with it. But my alert things were that there were studies into the feasibility of using synthetic fertilizers with it, using pesticides and biocides with it, and still claiming carbon credits. So that just puts, like, to me, it goes brr, brr, like, big alarm bell.
This is part of where I want to go with this, because these are the terminologies that, you know, most people just rock up to the shopping center, they'll grab their food, you know, they'll, you know, either follow a fad at the time that I'm going to eat a particular way. and not even give an idea of what it's actually about. And that's, you know, sequestering is really interesting because one of the things that I've been learning about with some of the information you guys have been sharing with me and other things that I've been listening to is that it's not just about the sequestering of just carbon. It's actually about how do we actually hold the nutrients within the soil? How do we first create those nutrients? And also the holding of water and the movement of water as well. And so it's a very interesting word that just seems to be popping up in my mind. Biodiversity. Yeah. I'll throw that to you, Dan. What's biodiversity to you?
Well, from my perspective, when I think of biodiversity, I think of plants to start with. And I think of plants of all different plants, from trees down to tiny little weeds and mosses, and then I think of what they sustain, because soil is a byproduct of plants.
That's big.
Yeah, it's
we'll
a
go,
big.
We'll dig into that a little bit in a bit, but
so if we have. So if we understand that to make soil, we need plants, right? And then to make really good soil, we need to have biodiverse plants. Because if we have huge amounts of biodiversity, then you have then what that brings is, you know, biodiverse fungi, biodiverse insects, biodiverse you know, and then on top, biodiverse birds, biodiverse animals, biodiverse environments, it's just such a knock-on effect. And I think that's one thing that it's another term, like what you said with sequestering carbon and, you know, sustainability and regenerative, and that we all know that if we have a veggie garden in our backyard, we all know that we have to have, you know, either compost or really healthy soil or something to grow our veggies in. So we understand that soil is important, but a lot of people don't understand what is soil. So in soil is rocks and sand and organic material. Now that organic material comes from plants. So soil is a byproduct of plants. So that's it, just pulling that back into why biodiversity is important. So if we can understand that if we have incredible biodiversity, we have that knock-on effect of incredible species feeding on that organic matter, and they're all going to be different, and they're all going to be working, you know, alongside each other, and they're all going to be creating this beautiful, healthy soil. And there's just so many functions of plants that I won't even get into now.
Yeah, that's right. We can go there in a little bit, which I think.
Well, yeah, because there's just so many functions. How they you know, individually pull up minerals, how they make compounds, how they recycle water, how they manage our water cycles, how they photosynthesize, how they process the sun's energy, how they use that energy to give us life. And as a transfer, as energy being, you know, that you can't get rid of energy, it just gets transferred into something else. It's still an energetic, I don't know what you call it, thing.
How they draw water uphill, you know, which is really interesting.
Oh, yeah, that was that capillary action.
That capillary action as well.
I think that was something I think because Peter, you know, is constantly surprised at how the landscape responds, because even after 40 years of doing this, there's little things that will continue to surprise him. I think that was one of his surprises, that when we put in a contour channel, so it's just a level channel, and so allow water to sit in there and hold it and slow it, basically creating a wetland as well. So that, yeah, that capillary action is that plants will draw a bit sort of uphill, and then you think that over a period of years or whatever can keep drawing that. So yes, effectively water,
which is really interesting. So look, probably to give a bit of context to this, where are you guys based? What region of Australia?
South Coast, New South Wales.
Yeah. And you've got a bit of land out there, Charles?
Yeah. It's about 360 acres
Yeah.
on a river and a creek.
Yeah.
Brogo River and Brogo Swamp Creek.
Yeah. Cleared land, was it, or predominantly cleared?
Yeah, it was pretty predominantly cleared. I mean, most of the country's been cleared over time, certainly burnt. But when we bought it, it was certainly a lot more cleared than it is now. Was over-cleared. And, yeah, the previous owner used to run pretty high density of cattle, high stocking rate, and they used to just let the cattle go into the creek, and they had we bought the place in 2010, which was at the end of the millennium drought or whatever they called it, but we're still in drought when we bought it. So yeah, the cows had been in the creek for years, I guess, and then soon after we bought it, the drought broke, and we had a massive flood. And I was telling you the other day how we had a massive erosion event happen because it was so dry and had been overgrazed and depleted by the cattle in the creek, damaged. And yeah, so all the creek bed disappeared, washed away. And so yeah, that's how my journey started in trying to repair it. But,
because you ended up connecting in via somebody said, you know, maybe have a chat with Peter, or a particular person, and he linked you in with Peter.
Yeah, I hadn't heard of him. I hadn't watched much TV or whatever, and hadn't seen him on Australian Story. But yeah, I soon got in touch with him, and yeah, I've been, you know, working with him and communicating with him since 13 years or so ago. Yeah,
he's an incredible soul. I mean, and Peter's we're keen to have a chat with Peter. You know, in a future episode, which is great, and I think all four of us will, or three of us plus Peter, will you know, sit down and have a conversation around the significance of this, because I think the perspective that you guys will bring to the conversation is paramount because of the experience that you've actually had, but also the passion that you actually have for this space. But even more so, you've seen the evidence of the change that can go on, which I think is, you know, in such a short period of time. And I know this is the work that you're starting to do on the farm down where you guys are in the south coast of New South Wales. And I know that, you know, you went through the horrific fires through there that I remember, you know, we lost contact for 48 hours. And in that time, I didn't realize you and Danny were fighting the fires and trying to keep it from burning the house down, you know, and which was huge. So you saw another devastating effect of fires that went through, and you know, and the reasons for those we could certainly, you know.
Well, it was interesting. Actually, it was very interesting. So when Charles was just speaking about how fire affected Australia, that to see how one burning event of our landscape, how that severely affected it. I mean, we're riddled with pop-up eucalypts. So and I think we lost all of the cherry bolet, which is a native cherry.
Mm-hmm.
From what I understand, someone had told me that it works sort of parasitically. I like to say symbiotically. It sounds mean. it's a tree that grows off another tree. It's got beautiful wood. It looks like cherry wood. Like that's why they call it native cherry. I can't remember its proper name, but it's and I think they're all burnt on the property. Hey, they're all gone.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. One fire event. So you can then start to understand if this is happening time and time again.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, how a landscape can change.
Incredibly so, and which actually links me into probably two other terms that I wouldn't mind going into is deciduous plants and the importance of those, but also what's a repair plant? What is a repair plant?
Well, I suppose, yeah, what the repair is based on the fact that plants can restore balance, you know, in the soil, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
So they're, you know, it's I guess it's a term that recognises the fact that plants can repair imbalances, problems in the soil.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, so I guess one of the ways that I look at it, you know, since I've been around Peter and, you know, thinking along those lines, every plant can be an indicator. And that's what I was saying the other day, what the first thing you do when you come into a landscape, and that's what Peter does, is to look at the plant species, what they are and where they are.
Mm-hmm.
And so the plants indicate what's happening in that time and space in that soil.
Yep.
So if the soil is really healthy, and then the most edible grass will grow.
Yeah, right.
And
yeah.
If the soil is completely depleted, then, you know, the least edible plant will grow. And then there's a whole range, you know, in between that. So at the top end, as if the soil depletes from that, you know, perfect scenario, then, you know, a not the best grass will grow, you know, a mm-hmm. secondary type grass, and so on, and down to, you know, a not very nutritious, or a not very sought after or palatable grass.
Mm-hmm.
And then you sort of, then you go into the non-edible plants spectrum, you know, depending on the state of, you know, the depleted nature of the soil in that time and space.
It's almost like these plants that are not the most palatable, it's almost like saying, leave us alone, let us regenerate, and then I'll bring back the good stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is basically, that seems to be what it is.
Yeah, it is.
Let's go through a little bit of that, because I really would love to, and I wrote some notes the other day about all this sort of stuff, but I'd actually love to sort of go through what it is that you guys do with a farm. I know I've had the privilege of being out to a farm that you guys were doing some of the heavy lifting work on, and you know, that had already been under the wisdom of Peter, you know, in the restoration of that area. And it was quite interesting driving through other farms which were sort of connected by a you know, the same road, and you could see that the significant difference once you hit that land that was sort of worked through from a, and again, I'm using the term regenerative agriculture, because we could see regenerative agriculture. There's assumptions that it, well, not assumptions, but people can say we do regenerative agriculture, but we use a bit of spray on the side, sort of thing, which, you know, you look at it and you go, okay, was that truly regenerative agriculture? Or is that, you know, is there a different way you could actually work without actually having used those biocides, I think you call it, Danny. So, yeah, can you step me through what would you do with your land? You've got 300-odd acres there. What would you do with your land? What's your first point of call? Obviously the plants, looking at the plants, but what's the other thing you look at?
Yeah, well, I guess the hydrology is the first thing, I suppose, because the way I look at it, nothing's possible without water, and everything's possible with it. And you know, life first started from a water body. You know, I haven't got it clear in my head that sort of history, but if you listen to Walter Yoni, he explains it all really well.
Beautiful.
You know, life on land started from the book, from water.
Mm-hmm.
And spread from there. So, yeah, to get the hydrology reinstated, and that you can do that by, you know, observing the, analysing the landscape, and you know, to things I've learnt from Peter to be able to read the landscape and see where the hydrology is and where it used to be and how to reinstate that.
Mm-hmm. So this is probably one of the big things that we're actually seeing with the dysfunction of again, you know, it's, you know, the impact that on the biodiversity of plants that has been sort of diminished, then the allowance of the water to, instead of it being diffused through the land, it's cut swathes through the land, which has actually then moved the natural flow of how water would have worked pre, you know, however, you know, tens of thousands of years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Now we're seeing the effect of that, and then the infect of that on the pop, you know, the fertility of the land as well, you know, or lack thereof.
I think that's why Peter says it's, you know, that these are, it's not something he's sort of just pulled out from somewhere, it's from his observation. So because it's very one of the awakening bits, I guess you could say, is to realize that the plant species that we grew up with, or we consider as Australian bush, and is actually an indicator of a dysfunctional landscape. But it's been so heavily impressed on us that it's very hard to change that mindset unless you sort of have that bit of an awakening to see, oh, okay, the landscape functioned a bit differently and it had different species on it. And there are areas that all we have left are basically a monoculture of eucalypts and plant species that maintain a desert effectively.
And just go back to what I was saying before about the plants being indicators. You know, if the soil is in a perfect condition, then the most edible grass will grow. And as it depletes, you know, the less or completely non-edible. And, you know, you get thistles as sort of getting towards, you know, like you're saying, it's the plant saying, just keep away from here. I need to do some serious work here to fix this soil. So that's, you know, one of the functions of the thistles.
Yep.
Blackberry.
You know, yeah, blackberries and that sort of thing. They keep the animals away from where they shouldn't be. But, and, you know, this is stuff I've learnt from Peter, but when he sees that when the soil is really depleted and in a really bad way, that's when a eucalypt will grow. So the eucalypt is past the thistles and past the blackberries. It's basically, in simple terms, Mother Nature said, look, this piece of soil here is completely fucked. And so my last resort is I'm going to send a eucalypt taproot down as far as I can to try and draw up some minerals and start again in a way.
So I didn't think about that with taproots, because you look at within a really thick jungle. You know, I was in Vanuatu just recently and going through some of the jungles through Santo and stuff like that, and you know, it could be argued a lot of that has been cleared and burnt and all that sort of stuff as well. But you see that it's a very superficial layer of you know, of root system, you know, and they use buttress roots on almost on top of the soil as opposed to these big significant tap roots, right? So there's that's what we see when we're looking at it, a very infertile soil. It'll try and get as much as it possibly can through many, many layers, sort of thing. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, so that, like I say, if when Peter goes into a landscape to look at it and to see what to do to fix it, if he sees eucalypts growing like we've got all around here a lot, you know, it's like Danny said, since the fires, a lot of the areas, it's just, you know, eucalypts coming up like hairs on a cat's back. That's an indicator that it's in a really bad way. You know,
yeah.
if if it wasn't so bad, then a thistle would grow. But if it was in a good condition, then an edible grass would grow. But yeah, if it's really bad, then eucalypt is one of the plants that will grow.
I listened to Peter Andrews, and he was chatting to a local or particular area for him, Indigenous elder, and they were talking about the burning of the bush, and it was a beautiful side of things, because Peter had actually was, this is a, you know, an elder that was, you know, really starting to understand things, you know, and see the significance of it. And one of the biggest concerns was is that, you know, we don't want to hurt mother. I think the term was along those lines, referring to the land. And Peter said, well, imagine if your mother had been in a really bad accident and she needs to get a little bit of cosmetic surgery done, you know, you'd be okay with that. And it was like, oh, yep, understand exactly what you mean, you know. And I love that analogy, because I think there is, you look at that land that you're on at the moment, we've just had a roaring bushfire come through there. We've got a desertification. It's a hard word to actually get out. You know, that's actually going on. And the life that can be sustained in that is a gum tree. You know, there is a bit of plastic surgery that needs to be done. What are you guys going to do? What's your first point of call?
Yeah, well, like we were talking about the other day, we're in the process of setting up an irrigation system to pump water from the river, because we have dams on the property, but the catchments aren't huge. They were almost dry when the fires happened a few years ago. But the river is very reliable. We're just downstream of the Brogo Dam wall, which is the main water supply, or one of the main water supplies for Bega Valley, Brogo Dam. So, yeah, we're going to pump. It's about 2 kilometres from the river up to the top of the property.
Yep. So this is trying to take place of the capillary action that we would see with the natural movement of water up the land, and also the ability of the land to hold water because of its
the holding of the water. And, we're just going to recycle it again. We're not going to we're not stealing the water, and it's not going to do anything. We're going to run it through the landscape from the top. And run it through so it can everything can be rehydrated, and it'll reach a certain point where it'll start to function properly again, like it used. Well, it'll start to function again.
It's almost like you're priming. It's like you know. I remember back on the farm, we used to have to prime the pump. You know, once you get the pump primed and it's starting to work, then you can actually go, "All right, okay, that's fine." But that initial effort that's required to get that water move it, and it's primed, and now it can actually, it has its own legs, you know, and it can actually do it.
Because there's, I mean, there was this, it all would have been forested before humans interfered with it, so you know that would have had its daily water cycle would have been active, and there would have also, there's wetlands, or there should be wetlands down on the floodplain areas, but there's also, you know, wetlands as you go up into the landscape. There's lots of wetland areas have been lost higher in the landscape as well, you know. So
yeah, right, yeah.
Daily water that, like we'd spoken about with you, because one of the main things that farmers keep an eye on is annual rainfall. When's it going to rain next? When's it going to rain next? And that's important. But the consideration that there are different water cycles on a farm. So water as a resource on your farm, you can do things a lot better, and you can tap into the different water cycles on your property, whether that be atmospheric, and then you've got dew, and then encouraging drawing in, and that's getting that hydrological function working again, and then getting the plant species in there that can work the best with those different water cycles. So effectively, yep, in the end, you can start creating microclimates on your farm. So we can sort of be a bit down in the dumps and going, can we do stuff now to affect everything happening? We can get to that stage, but we can do something on our land where we can start to create microclimates on our property.
Well, this is incredible. So if we just purely dump water on the land, it's not going to do anything. What do you have to do to diffuse that water so it's not just pouring through the land? What's the next steps? So if you're pumping that water,
plants.
Say again.
We'll pump it to a pond, mm-hmm, on the high point, and which is obviously then you've got perched water, water that's sitting relatively higher than the soil around it, basically, mm-hmm, which then allows gravity to take effect and to push the water into the soil below the surface,
yep,
and into the root zones of the plants,
mm-hmm,
and away it goes then, the plants, getting the plants growing vigorously and biodiversely that's the key.
Mm-hmm.
As much as you can do that without the water evaporating is also key. And, like I said, we'll create ponds, and naturally the reeds will grow, mm-hmm, in that area where the water's going into the ground.
Yep.
It creates like a negative pressure, Peter likes to deem it.
Mm-hmm.
And naturally, that's where reed beds will grow.
Yeah, right.
And that'll prevent evaporation.
So you look at that. So I know Peter, in an interview I was listening to, talked about that when he was some of the farms in South Australia, because he was brought up in that Broken Hill region.
Yeah.
Said, the biodiversity of the weeds had dropped off. I think it was potato weed, Patterson's curse, and soursop. And it was only three, particular weeds. Do you find and have you experienced that they naturally start to come back off their own volition, or is there something you have to introduce, or is it there's obviously reeds and all that sort of stuff will come through with the birds, to a degree, I guess. So I guess the birds carry some of the seeds, or at least help with that transplanting of them.
Yeah, it's a bit of a magical. There's a seed bank in the, yep, soil.
There's a seed bank,
and it's actually, that is one of the most phenomenal things to see, is what actually does come back. And just tying it back to when you were talking about the mother, that's another concept that when we because we actually have original peoples that do promote water in the landscape and not burning. So, but they're not heard of as much. Hopefully that'll change. If the mother's allowing that plant to grow there, then okay. The mother says it's okay.
Well, you look at our Lake Eyre, I don't know the history of that land out there. I would have said it would have been forested at one stage. But, when those big rains happen, before it's almost desert, then all of a sudden there's this proliferation of just flora, mm, going on out there, not to mention the bird life that comes out there. And, we obviously know the nutrients that come through the birds defecating in the water, et cetera, et cetera. And so there's a nutrient sort of dump there. But, yeah, it's interesting. So really what it is, it's a bit about how can we prime it? How can we maybe change the contours a little bit so the water is slowed through its diffusion? Dan will probably go to the hedgerows in a second, which would be really interesting because they do have a part in the, you know, creating a bit of biodiversity within the landscape. The soil starts to regenerate itself, and to the original point where it may not be the most edible plants, but that's okay because we need to actually have
it. Yeah. Well, something after we had that talk the other day, Danny played it back to us, and obviously, you know, I was listening to it from a critical perspective sort of thing, criticising myself, I guess. and one of the things that came out was how often I answered your question by saying I don't know, and obviously that's not ideal for you. That's not what you want to hear from.
It's refreshing.
But don't forget, I mean,
if you don't know, don't answer the question.
But I'll jump in on that for just a quick second because I think this is what's really important. Part of the reason why I wanted to start this podcast is to have a nutritious conversation where we're going into the unknown and there are things that we're going to expose where I don't know, but I got a gut feeling there's something here.
Yeah.
Well, this is, what Charles
unlocks.
Obviously, like I said to Danny, you know, initially when I mention it, it's going to be I'll be defending myself, you know, the ego, rah, rah, rah.
Yeah.
But there's a couple of reasons for it. And, you know, when I first started talking to Peter and, you know, and it was, you know, straight away, I was talking to him one day and I think I was at his property 2 days later and then he was here and we've been, you know, communicating ever since. And sometimes it's been, you know, because I had my own business in the mines. I was only a few hours drive from where he was living. And I'd get phone calls, you know, at any, you know, literally late at night. Can you pick me up at 6 o'clock in the morning? You know, we've got to be in Narra Court at 10, you know.
Yeah, really?
Tomorrow morning. And, you know, so I've been on 14-hour drives with him, you know, like, and I'm talking straight. And, you know, we had to be in southern Queensland one day and then literally Narra Court the next day sort of thing. You know, that's how he sort of organises himself, even though, yeah, it's not organised, but well. But anyway, I spent a lot of time with him and that's, you know, we talk and observe the landscape, you know, the whole time. You know, it was just, you know, we didn't just sort of general chit-chat. It wasn't a part of the conversation, you know. It was always about this, you know, the landscape and but also the politics of it all, you know. It started political at the time. I was in the mines and I had my own business at the time, but my business partner criticised me that I was more like our employees' union rep than I was their boss sort of thing. And it's just, that's just my nature, you know. So Peter had told me all about this political fight that he's in all the time and had been for years. So that's how it started for me. Was I offered to come to these meetings and if I actually heard what politicians or bureaucrats actually said to him and promised him, then I could back him up and, you know, remind them that you said this and you said that. Mm-hmm. So it was sort of a political, it started from a political point of view really with me.
Beautiful, yeah. And,
you know, the observing what's actually happening in the landscape sort of came as you know, subsequently after that. But so in the early days, you know, when I'd talk to him and listen to him, especially in the landscape, I'd delve into the, you know, the depths of it all. And, you know, because I think I've got the capacity to understand lots of things. So I wanted to know the nitty gritty of it sort of thing. And I remember one day that, you know, Peter pointed out that to not lose sight of the simplicity within the complexity, because like Danny was saying the other day, it's so complex, but, you know, there's simple things that are always true, and you can sort of work your way through the whole thing just by going from one simple thing to the next.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the sun shines, the plants photosynthesize, and, you know, really break it down into the simple notions. But then there was another, so what Peter was saying, you know, you could see that I was getting, I guess, frustrated with myself for not being able to understand and sort of, you know, going down the wrong avenue or whatever. So he brought me back to don't forget about the simplicity. But then there was another time I was in Sydney with Peter at a conference type thing, and it was with scientists and bureaucrats, and the discussion was around the need for data collection, because that was often why Peter couldn't get any traction from a, you know, government funding, I guess, point of view, was that there wasn't enough data collected. You know, so basically what they were saying is, you know, you could watch that Australian story or do what I did with the Yanks and drive around all over the state in the height of a drought and go to properties that are green and lush and have water, but that's not scientific proof to say that it works. You know, so we need to keep collecting data to prove that it works before we'll fund you to go and go for it, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
So that was the topic of discussion sort of thing. And one of the scientists there was Stuart Hill, Professor Stuart Hill, who
ecologist.
Yeah, he's a social ecologist now, but he's you know, got multiple degrees, I think, and environmental science is sort of one of them, but then sociology as well.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, he's a really interesting fella. And they got him, you know, asked for his opinion sort of thing. And I'll never forget, he was on, got up on the stage, whatever, and there was a whiteboard there, and he got the marker and drew a circle as big as he could on the whiteboard. And he said, if everything inside that circle represents everything there is to know about what's happening, you know, in the ecology, basically, you know, what's happening in the soil, what's happening in the plants, what's happening in the atmosphere, everything, all the science, all the chemistry and everything that there is happening, the circle represents everything there is to know. And then he put a dot in the middle of it. He said, that's what we do know. So, the point he was making was we're never going to know everything. So, we need to forget the need for scientific data. And there was a couple of ways, things that he said that sort of rung in my mind. And he basically said to a group of the scientists that were pushing the need for data collection was, this time, you know, you come behind the bulldozers rather than go in front. You know, let us get in there with the bulldozers and start rearranging the landscape and get the function happening again. And you guys come behind and see what has happened. Don't go in front of us trying to predict what will happen. Yeah. You just look behind and see what's happened. So, and then another comment that he made was what he thought about this need for the scientific data. He said, we're measuring our own extinction, and he just sat back down again. In other words, you know, like, yeah, it was really shocking.
That's powerful stuff that, you know.
Yeah,
and I think this is what we actually find is that, you know, a paralysis through analysis is the term that comes to mind. And I think, you know, we – at the moment, the way things are going, it reminds me of that nursery or that story, the little old lady who swallowed a fly. I don't know why she swallowed a fly. Perhaps she'll die. Then she swallows a spider to catch the fly. And then she swallows. And it's this continual, you know, and you're just sitting there going, all right, she ate a fly, for God's sake. And, can we actually look at something a bit different now? Can we actually, rather than keep going down this avenue of more and more and more? Because
the other day, I jotted down a few notes when I was, like I said, listening to our first conversation, and then I wanted to I was going to give you a call, but then Danny said we're going to do it again and have another go. So I left it till now. Just trying to think now what I was going to say there.
You think and I'll talk.
That's okay. That's why I butted back in.
But again, don't forget the context.
There is lots of science that's been done anyway. Yeah. Yep.
Just, don't forget the context of this is that we're not going to get everything right. And what it is actually to explore, because I think one of the things that we've lost, as a society and as a community and as an individual is the ability to actually have difficult conversations. And I don't mean difficult in the sense of adversarial and yelling at each other, but I mean difficult conversations in the sense of let's explore this. Because if we keep only working from what we know, we'll always get what we've got. But if we actually go, hang on a second, let's move forward. We can use that knowledge, but let's actually have a bit of wisdom moving forward where we actually have a conversation and go, shit, I didn't think of it that way. I had a conversation yesterday with a beautiful lady, and we're talking about, what does this word mean to you? And then we're talking about health. And she went, God, I've never thought about that. What is health?
He's got it.
Yeah, well, no, that's what I wanted to, because part of the sort of inspiration for us to have these conversations is for you to have more of an idea of what you're going to talk with Peter about.
Absolutely.
So that's where I was coming from. So I didn't. When I wanted to tell you that the circle and the dot story, Danny would have heard me say it 100 times at least, and the simplicity within the complexity.
Yeah.
But I'm sure where you're at with all of this, the complexity, you want to delve into the complexity, I'm sure you as well. So, I think, I don't, with what I'm saying about that, I'm not saying to you, don't try and understand it all. Don't ask Peter, this question or that question, because, I'm sure like I said about myself, I considered myself having the ability to understand it all. But, but then when you hear a such highly educated professor saying that, the circle and the dot, you're never going to know it all sort of thing.
Can I just say as well, there is lots of science being done that you can research. There's, I can't remember her name, Anna Marikova or something, a quantum physicist. Amazing research on the biotic pump. Lots of research in lots of different areas, but there isn't a lot of research into plant function, which is my interest. And the reason why there's not a lot of research into plant function is because there's no funding available to work out why a plant is growing there or functioning in that landscape. There's lots of research and lots of money being spent on getting rid of a plant and how to get rid of that plant, but no research or funding going into studying what is that plant doing there, what is its function, what is it doing. And, we have thousands of different species of plant. There's lots of research out there if we want to do it, but it's not happening. And, we also know from just even from a medicinal background, we know a lot of information about plants. And there have been some countries that have done some great, Germany's one that has a fantastic scientifically researched medicinal herbal side or I can't remember what they call it, herbal research thing. And when we all know that most pharmaceutical drugs come from herbs, the active constituents in herbs, and disregard the rest. So that's another point for me, that we don't know about plants. So when we talk about plant function, why is a plant there, to just get rid of it is nonsensical, because you just don't like it, because you hate willows, because Patterson's curse, because I look at it and I go, well, Patterson's curse is an early pollinator. That means that pollination insects can come out and feed on it, and you know it's an indicator. It's there. Something's happening there. But we're so into demonizing these plants, and we have no understanding whatsoever of what it's doing in the landscape, and scientifically or otherwise.
I think this is what's really important, and I guess this is where we're going. I mean, part of the conversation is building a repertoire of understanding, you know, to be able to sort of have a great conversation with Peter. But the other part is the wisdom that you guys have actually, you know, are birthing at this point in time, and the understanding that you've actually got, and the contextual understanding. Because if we put a context with this, and I'll do this as a bit of a, you know, at the very start as the intro, when I do a separate intro to this, well, it'll be actually talking about why is this important? Why is it important to actually know this? Because at the end product of this is that, you know, the conversation I listened to with, you know, with one of the things with Peter was he was saying that he remembers that they didn't have to immunize the sheep. They didn't have to drench the sheep. They didn't have to use all these, you know, parasite chemicals on the sheep and stuff like that, you know. And then all of a sudden, you know, the fertility rates dropped. The productivity of these, you know, the wool, if we looked at from a sheep perspective, and all of a sudden they're having to immunize and they're having to, you know, use drenches and all that sort of stuff, things that weren't there. And so what we're looking at is that, you know, Peter's the ethos behind where he's sort of kicked off with things is that biodiversity is so damn important because you know, and as we were chatting off camera before, you know, one of the things that we've looked at is that, you know, the first point of call that a person will do is actually move away from, you know, they want to get healthy. So they go, okay, well, stop eating processed food. All right. And as they go along the continuum, eventually they'll end up as an organic food, most probably. All right. Now, the beauty of an organic food is it's a moving away from pesticides, unless you've got the appeal label on it, which is really interesting. If you have a look at the appeal label, it's 3% citric acid, I think it is, and 97% don't know what it is.
Yeah. Yeah, you a certain percentage sometimes in products. I found that with in the beauty industry as well. There's a percentage you can put whatever.
And you could say olive oil in your thing, but it only has to have a percentage of olive oil. So this is the important. But what I actually find is that, and then normally what will happen is people end up sending off assays to try and get an idea of what deficiencies they have in their body. There'll be hair samples, there'll be blood samples, there'll be stool samples, there'll be urine samples, saliva samples, you know, and they'll be trying to work out what's going on with it. And then they'll start to supplement those sort of things. Now, what's really interesting about it is if we actually start to work, you know, all of a sudden we start to go, what is a biodiverse farming look like? What is it, a biodiverse farm? What does it actually look like from a, you know, how it actually feeds the soil? You know, how do the plants feed the soil? And how do we work that? And then eventually the trickle-on effect is that how does that come into our body? You know, and then what sort of energetics do we actually have from that? You know, an amazing bloke, you know, and I think it's also comes from, you know, with the Hippocratic Oath, Hippocrates, you know, where he says, you know, food be thy medicine, you know, and you go, that's it. You talk about simplicity, Charles. That's simplicity right there. So the next complexity to that question, your food. Where does it come from? Is it biodiverse? Has it actually got, because you can take those active ingredients out, which is what the industry, you know, the medical industry has actually done, but is it really in a form that we can actually utilize?
Yeah.
You know, is it, do we need all those substrates, you know, that it actually comes packaged in? You know, do we need the true whole food, the biodiverse food? And the answer is, coming back to Peter's analogy of the sheep, is that, yes, we absolutely do need that. We need that because otherwise we're going to have to start immunizing these sheep. We're going to have to start drenching these sheep. We're going to have to start using all supplements with these sheep and all that sort of stuff. And we go down this, you know, the woman who swallowed a fly and then she swallows a spider and then she, you know, goes down that avenue because all we're doing is we're chasing a losing battle as opposed to coming back to what Mother Nature can actually truly do. You know, which is quite astounding. And we've seen it, we've lost civilizations around the world where the jungle grows back. You know, you see it like, you know, all these amazing sort of discoveries they're doing, archaeological discoveries. And that'd be a really interesting discussion, because you could almost hypothesize that civilizations have dropped out because of their farming.
I would say that that's one of the main ones. Mm. Like, you look at the area of the Fertile Crescent, and it's not a secret, like, them finding archaeological remains and then realizing it was intense farming practices and burning and all that. Like, it's not a secret. Like,
not at
you
all.
Just join the dots.
Yeah.
And so that's another reason why we're interested in, we consider Peter our elder, is because he's joined a lot of the dots. And
love that.
And he's an elder. And he's been able to work out ways to improve it and to do things differently, where we're in line with that natural process of things on a farm. You know, I guess, you know, they call it the natural sequence farming. And so we can actually improve, we can keep improving the landscape. We're not going to keep depleting it, which most every civilization has done.
Yeah. And this is the thing, is to your point, Charles, it's simple. You know, it is really simple. You know, and the beautiful thing is that, and I like the definition of pronoia. You know, paranoia is the universe is conspiring against us, whereas pronoia is it's conspiring for us. And you see that with Mother Nature, with you know, if you were to call it Gaia, you know, there is that conspiring to actually let's bring the health back into that space. You know, if we can tap into that wisdom and actually start to flow with it, you know, and there might be some heavy lifting we have to do to get there.
We're getting feedbacks at the moment. We're getting extremes in weather, you know, hurricanes and flooding and drought. Like, we are getting feedback. And so how do, you know, we fix that? And like I've said to you before, that the Earth's heat dynamics, water governs 95% of the Earth's heat dynamics, and CO2 governs 4%. So knowing that water governs 95% of the Earth's heat dynamics, and we can do something about it on agricultural land, which takes up, I can't remember what it was it like 38% or something like that, 38%. And that's, you know, that's disregarding terribly regenerating forests, deserts and all of that. We're just talking land that's being farmed agriculturally. And, you know, plantations, I don't know, you know, it's another rabbit hole, but a lot of the plantations around the world are eucalypts. It's a very kind of, it's like they're huge because eucalypts are such an amazing hardwood and they're so tolerant to lots of different conditions, including low fertility, including low water, include, you know, so they're grown around the world as plantation trees on a huge scale. But yes, anyway, getting back to knowing that we can repair the water cycles and use them more efficiently on our land, we're starting to approach how do we to affect changing those heat dynamics just, you know, from our farm. And if we can get, you know, everyone joining in and doing that, we can really affect change. And, you know, and I pointed out before that even if we draw, which is great, you know, we can draw down CO2 from the atmosphere and store it as soil organic carbon, some in plants, but store it in the soil. The ocean is a giant carbon sink and it will equalize, it will release more carbon. So I don't know how that looks. I don't know what those numbers look like, but it, what I do know is it's going to take a long, 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 long time to focus on the CO2, but we can affect change with how we farm very quickly and make a difference very quickly and start drawing down CO2, start changing the water cycles on our farm, start growing more biodiversity, so we can have some really amazing change. This is a very simple solution.
And as a consumer, starting to think where you actually get your food from, you know, are you investing in that in the, you know, in farms that are looking like that, you know. And I think, you know, this is the stuff that I'm really interested in is that, you know, the change is, you know, we make the change. I mean, this is a consciousness principle, is that you apply your wisdom first to yourself, and then the fruits of that is what flows into the world. And, you know, you can share the knowledge, which is part of the fruits, with that and the wisdom that sort of comes from it. But I think I'm just mindful of time, guys. So, because we wanted to touch on hedgerows, we might come back to hedgerows in another time, Dan. It's just going to be huge. I know it's your passion.
I know. No, that's all right. I'm still trialing some things, so I'm all good. Yeah.
We'll work on that. And, you know, maybe one day a bit of a walk through the land and actually start to see it. But I know just on your last point that you made, Dan, you know, and Charles, you've seen it as well. You know, in one season cycle, you know, one cycle, you know, you can start to see that change already occurring on those lands that have had that wisdom applied to it, you know, and it doesn't take long, you know. And I think, you know, the things I've listened to from Peter, it surprised him how quick things would actually start to turn around. And I think that's the stuff that's really exciting. But anything else you want to leave us with, Charles? You got a few notes from our last conversation.
Yeah, no, nothing specific, but yeah, something will come up. But
yeah, look, we're having a chat with Peter together, and yeah. And that's what's exciting, and more stuff will certainly come out.
We mightn't say much; we'll probably listen.
Yeah, but, that's okay.
You know, to Peter, like often when we sort of catch up with Peter in we do get a lot of one-on-one time, but a lot of the time it's we've got, you know, farmers. Working with farmers, and so there's a lot of questions, a lot of interest for me with nutrition and plants that I haven't even had time to ask him, which is why I said to you this would be great. So I'm going to be
a safe of information as well. Take notes, which is good, which would be beautiful. All right, I'll hit stop. We'll have a bit of a chat afterwards, guys. You know, love you both so much, and you know. I love that, you know, what you bring to the world and who you are as people. And, you know, there's so many things I'm so grateful for of having you guys in my life as well. So more power to you.
Yeah, cool. Right. Back to right at the start, you mentioned how you were, you know, the Peter's method of lobbying governments only works to a point, whereas, you know, I think you said we need to focus on the consumers rather than governments. Again, it's sort of like the simplicity, complexity. I don't want to tell you not to go down certain tracks with Peter, but you know, like I said, part of the reason you're talking to us is because of our connection with Peter and to give you some insight, I guess. So yeah, I wouldn't. Not saying you were going to, but I'm just making sure. I wouldn't get on there when you're talking to Peter and try and convince him that he needs to stop lobbying government because people
have
been.
You've got to do both. It's got to be.
You know, my old business partners, Mark and Connie, used to, you know, plead with him, sort of thing, that you're doing it all wrong, sort of thing. But he's just not going. He's not going to change. So.
No. I think you need to do both. I think we need to do both. Yeah. We need to be in the. We've got a governance that's in Australia that actually needs to be challenged. And I think, you know, the wisdoms, you know, some of the insights that are coming out, the importance of actually lobbying from a council level, the importance of lobbying from a state government level and a government level, and I think the more, you know,
well, there's all.
But change a lot of the time is really, you know. What we do know about the political landscape is they follow where the people go, you know, as a pharmaceutical industry will follow where the disease is growing with their interests. So too do the political side of things as well, you know, and I think we have to have both. You can't let that beast run in the background without actually calling it to task, or at least presenting it with information, you know. And the quote I'll probably use with Peter is that, you know, no army can stop an idea whose time has come, And so, but to have that idea and not bring it forth, it's not going to do anything. So I think you're exactly right. It needs to be a two-pronged approach or a multiple-pronged approach. But I think the important thing, and this is what I'd love to chat with Peter about, is the important things of people taking ownership. And part of also this podcast is about, you know, taking responsibility and stop outsourcing. I'm going to be clear with that. Stop outsourcing our life, you know, and take responsibility. And I think that's the big thing that keeps coming out is that, you know, if you stop buying, you know, crap produce, well, the corporates that are actually selling it are actually going to start to move away
There's lots of layers. That's in itself is complex because, you know, they'll say, yes, we agree with the hydrology, but we cannot let weeds grow. And Peter's like, well, then don't do it.
which is
true because there's been other places that have taken on his ideas and are doing practices that are absolutely counter to the principles of it all. Like, and, you know, why are you doing that? And it's either for funding, for them to get ahead, for them to be in the right. So, and he's been very steadfast in saying it's all about plants and water. It's all about plants and water. You know, he's stuck by that because he realizes how important all of those pieces are working together. You cannot take one piece away and go, we'll continue on with that.
Yeah, which is great. All right, let's leave it there, guys. Much love.
Okay.
We'll hit stop and we'll have a quick chat afterwards. All right.
Okay.
Thanks, guys.
This has been a production of TheWellnessCouch.com. Check us out on Facebook and join in the conversation on Facebook.com/TheWellnessCouch. Subscribe to each show on iTunes and check us out on Twitter. The Wellness Couch, streaming wellness into your lives.
Whilst the Wellness Couch presenter endeavor to provide accurate and helpful information to their listeners, these podcasts cannot take into account individual circumstances and are not intended to be a substitute for health and medical advice from a qualified health professional. You should always seek the advice of a qualified health professional before acting on any of the information provided by any of the Wellness Couch podcasts.